This podcast contains material that some listeners may find distressing. Content includes explicit language and themes related to workplace bullying, harassment, sexual harassment, intimidation, stalking, physical and sexual violence, discussions relating to self-harm and suicidality, disordered eating, other mental health issues, sexism, racism, and homophobia. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Behind Blue Doors, a podcast where women and allies have the right to speak their truth and share their stories.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Behind Blue Doors. I'm Lee. I'll be hosting today, and we're going to be discussing the November 19th, 2021 incident where a Sunrise, Florida police sergeant named Chris Pulleese, P-U-L-L-E-A-S-E, Sergeant Chris Pulleese, grabbed the neck of his female coworker when she was attempting to stop him from using excessive force on male black in the back of his cruiser that was handcuffed. I've got two amazing police officers here with me today who have all experienced or know of a female who has experienced the same type of abuse with actual choking and hands around the neck. And I'm going to introduce Effie from Toronto Police. Thank you, Effie. Most people out there who listen to our podcast know who you are. And we've got Brenda. And thanks, everyone, for being here. If you just wanted to say hello.
Thank you for inviting us.
Hello.
Thanks, Effie. I appreciate it. And thank you, Brenda. So why don't we just start talking about, we've all watched this video. When you see it, what happens in your mind? Because you all have actually experienced another officer either doing this to you or to a coworker.
So my name is Effie. I'm a Toronto police officer. I've been a cop since 2008. I filed a human rights complaint in 2018 for sexual assault, sexual harassment, discrimination, racism. The reason I did that is because over the years, when I tried to file the complaint or talk to my supervisors, it was the same message over and over again. Think about your career. Think about the ramifications of your decisions. Basically dissuading me from reporting because they actually knew that it was going to be, you know, a very, very rough road. And so in 2018, I filed a human rights complaint because I thought, you know what, this is it. Like, I can't do this internal stuff. Nothing changes. Too many of us are suffering. Too many women, too many racialized officers. So I went public. And because of that, other officers started reaching out to me. Through that, I got to know a female colleague from Toronto Police who worked at a different division. And as an officer who's off sick and going through a lot for myself, it was really hard to hear these stories, but it's really important because it really opens your eyes about that you're not alone, that this isn't just something you're going through. So this friend of mine, she's a police officer. She's off sick as well now. She was trying to stop her colleague from assaulting a male who was in custody also. And the colleague turned around and punched her in the chest. So it started from there. And that's where her career started to unravel. And that's when her retaliation started, her harassment started. This officer went back and told her colleagues at the station they rubbed dog shit on her car. And this car was parked inside a police station. So it started from there. And over the years, you know, that kind of reputation follows you as a police officer. So when I saw that video, it really, really made me so worried for her. I was like, what's going to happen when this poor girl goes back to the station?
Yes,
and I thought if the camera hadn't recorded this, this girl would have been in trouble and nobody would have known and they would have blamed her. So I was so happy that this was caught on camera. I'm not surprised that he wasn't charged. This is just the tip of the iceberg of what women are facing. It's blue on blue violence. It's buried, it's silence, and it's horrific.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Effie. And I know the female you're speaking of, it was in the news. And again, there was a party under arrest. The male officer was continuing to be violent, is my understanding, right, with the accused party who wasn't resisting. And when I was watching the video of Christopher Pulleese, he looks like he's in a complete roid rage. No control. Like, you know,
it was like a tunnel vision. Like, he got out of his car. He went straight to the car. He didn't talk to the officers. To me, it looked like he was there to escalate things. Like, you know, when you see your supervisor come that hot and heavy and you know, it kind of, it's, you know, I've been there, like you stand back because he's your supervisor. And so when they do something like that, for this officer to do what she did, it was so brave. Like, it was so brave of her. And I was like, she's going to need a lot of support because this type of stuff is what gets women destroyed in the workplace.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Brenda.
What I noticed interesting about the video is obviously officer police that's attacking the female officer. But there was four people that I can see at that call. There's two other colleagues that watched and did nothing. And when the incident was done, I didn't see them approach the victim either.
I totally agree. I noticed that too. But I wasn't surprised by it. I'm sure none of us were surprised by the fact that no one else jumped in. First of all, the fact that she was brave enough to get involved and have the integrity to be like, whoa, 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 this is excessive. Like, what are you doing? Took so much courage on her behalf. And then you can see she's like half his size. She's a little thing, just like, you know, Effie, you're quite small. And Brenda, I'm not sure, but I'm not. So that's never been my experience. But the fact that no one comes to her aid, no one says anything, I wasn't surprised because we've all been taught to toe the blue line and you say nothing, right? So that I found that really unfortunate as well. And as him being the supervisor, like, you're supposed to be the leader out there. So these are the things that we see. And then this is the behavior that the young officers are taught and these young males that are coming into the police service, this is how they're taught to behave. This behavior is okay. And then the other whole issue there is we all know if someone had assaulted us while we're in uniform, they would have been charged for assault police for pushing their finger on my vest, right? Oh, assault police. Well, you are a cop and you just assaulted another officer as well. Like, you know, it has to be fair across the board. And it's the nepotism, it's the cronyism that we see everywhere. Brenda, Brenda, I know that you have a long story of different things that have happened. And I know today we're going to try and keep it just to, you know, the violence aspect of what you've experienced. If you can go ahead wherever it's comfortable for you.
My story is very similar, yet sort of different. It's interesting when I watched that video of that officer down in the States. I'd been working for one of the police services in the GTA area. And what had initially happened is I had been assaulted on a call and two of my fingers had been dislocated. And during the call, my partner left in the middle of the fight. So afterwards, I approached him and said, like, why'd you leave me in the middle of the fight? And he made some derogatory comment about two females fighting was affecting him sexually. So he had left. So anyway, it turns out...
Oh my God.
It turns out that I ended up arresting the person. And when they saw my partner at the hospital, they said to him, if you charge me, I'll tell your wife who you're having an affair with. And he went pale. And from that point on, he did everything he can to obstruct the charges. Tell me not to lay charges, didn't show up for the court case. So finally, after that, I approached him in the station. I said, like, what's going on? You've done everything to obstruct this. And he denied. And I was upset. And as I left the room, I made a vulgar comment about, you know, his male anatomy affecting his memory. And I went to the next room. About 5 minutes later, he followed me into that room. And the yelling started, and unbeknownst to me, I don't know at what point of this happened. I had an open mic, thankfully, because I had been facing the wall working on the computer. He came into the room yelling and screaming. I turned around and he grabbed me very similar to I'd stood up from my desk and he'd grabbed me by the neck, very similar to the video. So it had a lot of similarities. He pushed me against the wall, but then he grabbed my collar. We'd been wearing the shirts with the ties with the little clips, and he grabbed my collar and he twisted and I couldn't breathe. I just remember I couldn't breathe and I couldn't get my balance in order to fight back. And I couldn't figure out why I couldn't get my balance. But thankfully, I'd had an open mic. So other officers in the station came running in and they tackled him, thankfully. So what happened after that is, like, the next day, you know, you try to process. And the next day I'm trying to process it. And I realize I'm covered in bruises. Like my whole back is covered in bruises. So I'd gone back and looked at the scene and I realized it was like a storage room where I'd been working in, and the whole wall had all the boxes of paper piled up. So he'd been bouncing me off those. So all those little corners from the boxes had left bruises everywhere. And I'd learned later from one of the officers that had broken up the fight, he'd been trying to feet sweep me. And that's why I couldn't get my balance. But I can't figure it out because you're so focused on the not being able to breathe.
Yes.
Yeah. And then but then the hard part is that this service sort of did the right thing, sort of didn't. I was a fairly new officer, 3 years on. I think he had 17 years on. But they asked me if I wanted criminal charges laid. And at that time, I had wanted to be on the TAC team. So immediately, people from the TAC team told me, if you ever air our dirty laundry, you'll never be on the TAC team. So I said no, which was really bad advice in hindsight. But then he was charged with the service with two counts of discreditable conduct. He lost 48 hours. He was suspended without pay for 48 hours for the obstruct, trying to get me to drop the charges. And he forfeited 60 hours for the assault. And he had to take 8 hours of anger management courses, 8 hours of anger management, as well as 8 hours of ethics training.
I'm sure that solved the problem, Brenda. I'm sure everything was fine after that, right?
Well, it divided the platoon because, yeah. Well, and I guess the hard part after all this is as soon as it happens and there's PSA charges, you can't talk to anybody. It wasn't until like a year later that when the whole court case was done that I figured out why I couldn't catch my balance, right? It was hard because you've got all these fragments and you can't put them together and you can't figure it out why. And but what happened after that is he didn't stop. Like, he's definitely got some issues. Shortly after that, I transferred to another service in Ontario, one of the big five. And he actually, when he was convicted in this GTA service of having of the two discreditable conducts, there was a court case and he was convicted. He actually went to the JP in that jurisdiction and laid a private information of assault on me. And he served it on the chief of police at my new police service, where I'd only been a month. So their introduction to me was an officer who had criminal charges against another officer in their prior service. And that's followed me. Like, I've gone to my association for help, and the association, this is years ago, not the current one, looked at me and said, well, you had issues in Halton as well. And you carry a lot of that survivor's guilt, first of all. And then the other guilt too that I realize is false guilt now is, had I not made that comment to him about his anatomy affecting his memory, would the outcome have been the same? But that's ridiculous. See, that's not a reason to be assaulted, for sure. But the other interesting thing about this GTA service is that after I left a few years later, they actually made him the liaison in charge of the women's shelters.
I can't. I wish the audience sometimes could see us, because all of us right now have had our hands over our heads and we're just like banging our hands on our head. Like, what? Like, really?
Yeah.
None of us are surprised. Really. He became the liaison officer for shelters with vulnerable women.
Yeah.
Yeah. That seems logical, right?
It was interesting. Like, my story is a little different, that I did have bystanders. There was one officer in particular that did intervene, or I think it would have been a much different outcome.
Yeah, because rarely do we see that. So I'm glad that you did have some people supporting you in that process. But like you said, then, I mean, how does he even come back at you to say you assaulted him in any way, shape, or form? And this is what I don't understand. I've heard lots of stories about, oh, well, then, you know, they came after me saying that I, you know, tweeted out their name and I did this or I did that, that they're somehow not an abuser, that now it's our fault. Terrible.
I think that's because they're getting support. That's because they have the union supporting them. They have the service supporting them. They have colleagues supporting them. I think one of the reasons why women are getting abused. Police women are getting abused and getting shoved under the rug and pushed aside as we're so isolated, we're so undernumbered. We don't really have any way of connecting with each other at work. They always put us against each other. They select the pick-me's to promote. And this sends a message. Like, we're all getting a message here. The message I got when Officer Police decided to choke that female was, how comfortable are you to go for somebody's neck? I have never in my life, and I've been a police officer, I worked in the busiest division downtown Toronto. I have never went for someone's throat, because that is the purpose they're living, is because they're breathing. And once you cut, you're choosing to cut someone's airway. So what gives you that confidence to automatically go for a woman's throat? And that tells me that we have abusers within the police service. We have sexual predators. We have racist people. We have homophobics. We have all kinds of officers that are being protected. And most importantly, the message the police service is sending to these officers, and even the good cops are receiving, is stay quiet. Don't say anything. Put your head down, because you will be punished like that person. They make an example of you for a reason. This is orchestrated, and it comes from the chief's office. These decisions to do this to us is coming from the top. It's no coincidence that reprisaled against when we speak publicly. My own chief, my own police chief, who's Chief Raymer, yes, 2 days ago when he was speaking about a senior officer who's been charged with cheating for promotional exam, his response in the paper is, if you have a problem, go to the supervisor. Your grievance should not be aired on social media. Well, how can we go to the supervisors when you promote these guys, when the sexual predators are promoted, when the racist cops are promoted, when the abusers and domestic abusers are promoted? How do you expect women to go to those same supervisors and receive support? And we've seen it over and over and over again. There is no support for women. So they want us to report to the same abusers so they can bury it, and so they can get rid of women with non-disclosure agreement and hire new recruits. New recruits so they can groom into being complicit, being comfortable with sexual violence, being comfortable in this area and this environment, because it is so geared for men to be comfortable being themselves in this area. Men can say whatever they want. They can talk about cheating on their wives. They can talk about, you know, arresting people and assaulting people, and they all get high fives. Women are walking a tightrope, and it is a dangerous place. And it is very dangerous, because this type of behavior is going to bleed, and it is bleeding into the communities. It is affecting the public, and most importantly, affecting women and the marginalized communities. Because these officers are, number one, most of them are white male. And number two, the union is all white male. So what we're seeing here is...
Mine is all white male, not one person of color. Ridiculous. Not even, they don't even have a police woman on our board.
Even one woman wouldn't make a difference, you know. We need to have equal seats. We can't have that. The power imbalance is so off, you know.
And the perspective, like, you don't have anyone at your table to give you a different perspective, say, hey, no, like, that's not how...
We need representation. We need representation. We need women. We need women of color. We need Black women. We need Indigenous women. We need everybody at the table, because clearly white men are only looking after white men's interests.
Oh, yeah.
I think our biggest hurdle is our unions. I think we need to have designated seats. They need to put aside seats for women, period. And it has to be... I don't know if that's something they would consider doing, but if we don't have the numbers, and we'll never have 50-50%, like, it will never be 50-50. So as long as there are women, we still need to have seats at the table. We should still have seats designated for women because of this issue. And it's not something that they can just hire women and hope for, because it takes a long time to, you know, be able to get to those numbers. Like, and we'll never get there the way they're going, because what they're doing is they're assaulting us. They're forcing peanuts on us, because they're cutting off our salaries. They're telling us you can't come back to work. Frankly, women, a lot of women are afraid to be in that environment physically. It's not comfortable to be around your abusers when they're all, you know, strapped up. They have guns, they have pepper sprays, they have egos, they have, they're very fragile. Some of them, like we heard earlier, you know, just because officer said to her, your testosterone or your, you know, your male, whatever, like, he went off the handle. Like, that is, it's just one of so many stories. Like, I've seen so many officers' with my own eyes at my own station getting abused over years. And what was I supposed to do, right? So when I finally did speak up, here I am now, 3-4 years later, publicly, twice they tried to give me a non-disclosure agreement and I refused and walked away because this isn't the way for women. This isn't the way to do it. It's not going to benefit me or the generations after us or even women that are at work right now. Somebody has to do something and the union has to be held accountable. That's who is bringing this down on us. That's who is not protecting us. That's who's taking our money and turning their backs on us. We've paid just like these men, but every single time we go to the union and say, I was sexually assaulted. I was called a sand N-word, excuse me. Whatever the case is, they tell you to do not bring up gender, do not bring up race or your career is over. So if that's the message you're getting, and this is the message that all officers are getting, that's why it's so easy to abuse each other and get away with it because there is no adults in the room. There's nobody watching. There's nobody taking the stand. Nobody's doing the right thing.
Yeah.
So I think how we have to go about it is figure out what's best for us and fight for it. Speak up for it. Keep going the way we are. And it's not easy because we don't have support. We don't have funds coming from the government. We don't have union funds. We're basically fighting with our own pockets. You know, I'm hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt right now because my union has refused to give me an ounce of support that those officers who sexually assaulted me got, right? So if we were to just sit back and say, they're going to not be happy because, you know, they're going to question how we got here. Well, we need to be there. Union seat is so that people are represented. And right now we're not represented. Right now there's just all white guys, all just high-fiving and looking after their, you know, guys that are causing trauma and, you know, they've never spoke up once about women. They've never said once anything about gender-based violence. Have you guys ever in your police services had your unions publicly support women? I've never seen it. But every time it was a man who got in trouble, they would always come and say...
Which is literally their job.
Yeah, it's every time. I mean, I've looked in the past for articles and Mike McCormick, who's our previous president of the union, he was like, every time there was even when the guys went into a bar and were, you know, flirting with women in uniform, Mike was like, it's part of community building. It's part of building a relationship with communities. When I filed a human rights complaint, he came out and said, none of these allegations have been proven in court. Who do you work for, Mike? Because you took my money too. And now you want to come sit here and talk about my allegations should be proven in court. When he knows damn well, we don't make it to court. They don't allow us to make it to court. They put so many burials in front of us. We don't even make it to court. So that's how they're positioned themselves every time a woman speaks out. It's none of these allegations have been proven. These guys fight for guys to have tattoos, to have beards, to have long hair, to wear shorts under their knees, but never about women, never about violence against women. Like we don't exist.
Thank you, Effie. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I did have a conversation with my union president and said, you know, when I had said to him, like, you guys have no police women, you have no one of color, no one from the LGBTQ community, like there's nobody. And he said, well, that's not my fault. And I said, it actually is. It actually is. I said, because you are not presenting something where it's comfortable, where people want to apply to work with in the union, because it's all your boys. Like that's basically what it is, you know, like, and we can say it's a spot or whatever, but what I've seen in our union is it's, you know, friends of the president who, you know, the next people who came in, like they all know each other. Right. So, Brenda, I know you, wanting to speak there. Go ahead, please.
I don't know. You talk about, seats at the table. I find we don't even own the house. I have the guest syndrome. Right? Like we're in someone else's house. It's their rules. We have to be on our best behavior. You don't criticize the hosts. And if you do, you get tossed out because it's not your house.
Love that. You're right. We're not even in the house. And that's why, like, and I've tweeted this out and stuff before. I said, like, that's when I realized that I couldn't have a seat at the table, that I couldn't have a voice at the table, that I was removed from the table. I started creating my own table. Right. And I feel like that's what we're doing. And they're angry about it. How dare you say this on Twitter? How dare you go to social media? Like, Lee, you're suspended because you're telling the truth about what we're doing. Okay. Well, at least I've
picked the seat at my own table. And if you're going to do reprisal against me for it, you know, I'm going to fight back, but it's pretty obvious what you're doing. So what needs, like, we've all talked about this numerous times. What needs to happen? How do we get the accountability here?
I think we can maybe circle back to that, the original story, and even the supports. And I know this is one of the big discussions going on in several police services, the psychological support. And I know that up in Ottawa at their last police service board meeting last Monday, there was an interesting comment made by one of the speakers who said gender-based violence is not a mental health issue. So I wonder what supports they have for this female officer. Are they going to be offering her psychological help? Because this is not a mental health issue. So what supports do we offer any of these officers that are experiencing these types of situations?
Well, I know for like with us, and I think Effie would say the same, like there isn't any, you know, as far as they're concerned, we're the problem. We created the problem, right? Like, how dare we report that we don't feel safe in our workplace?
I feel like to have real, meaningful, solid support, you need to clean the culture. And accountability, I think people underestimate how much victims want accountability and justice. We actually want to be part of the conversation. We want to be there and seeing results of what happens when we speak up. We want to see what good, meaningful change is. We're not seeing any of that. So I think to be able to build a real meaningful support system where people feel confident to come forward and want to tell their story and want help is to know that the last person who came got support and saw meaningful action, and they were able to go back to work and nothing changed and people didn't abuse them. Like, it didn't escalate. Like, all of that has to come together in a way that the support is really meaningful and long-term, because right now, you can have a support team, but what happens when you go back to work? Like, it has to be something that comes from the management. It has to come from the top. And for us, we're starting it. And I think it's so important for us that we brought our own table and we started talking and doing the podcasts and go public, because every victim, everybody who's, regardless of what, you know, what kind of abuse you suffered, you need support. You need to see that you're not alone. You need to see that there's other people like you out there. And once you build that community, once you build those bridges, then you can slowly heal. And that takes time, you know. So we are not even, for us, for me specifically, I haven't seen any kind of action, meaningful action from my police service. I haven't seen my chief take a step to investigate those officers. Everything I've seen up to now has been me and me first. They investigated me first. They reprisaled me first. They caught my pay first. I, you know, all of this stuff was, I said to myself, okay, so there's nowhere I can go within this service for support. So I came out, I spoke publicly, and I found support from somewhere else. But it's not the same thing, because at the end of the day, we're still suffering. We still need help, and it has to be from the government.
Well, and the last place I trust is talking to anyone in my police service about support.
That's the poison place that we know there is nobody, because anybody who speaks up will be singled out, will be retaliated against, will be abused, and they know it and we know it. So that's why I have support from work, but it's very quiet. Nobody knows who my friends are at work. There's people that come and tell me things and, you know, are supportive of me. But at the end of the day, when you look at it, you're standing by yourself.
Yeah. So, and that's all part of the trauma. You have the whole initial trauma, which there should be the appropriate supports to. But then compounded with that is you have the moral injury. When something bad happens, you expect there to be consequences for bad behavior, but there's not.
Sanctuary trauma. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And when this moral injury happens where you're supposed to be safe, you're rightly, it leads to sanctuary trauma. And I think it's the compound trauma that's profoundly affecting a lot of the female officers.
I was one of, I guess, two areas for me that really stick out on how things need to, like in order for things to actually change the culture. So one of them is this whole issue of police policing the police. It doesn't work because it's the cronyism and everyone's protecting each other. So there has to be an outside body where police officers within a police service can go and report outside of their own service, not to another police service, because we know all the chiefs are in bed together, tickling each other's balls. And my second one is there's no matrix on discipline. So when internal affairs starts investigating things, if you have, you know, the hockey guy who's got all his buddies and he's getting investigated for, let's say, an impaired that's been tossed out of court and he's fought the charges or whatever, and now it's Police Service Act charges or investigation, he's getting nothing. He's being taken care of. Whereas the female officer who got done with impaired is being thrown the book with the PSA. Not saying she shouldn't be. I'm saying they all should be. So there's no matrix to follow that holds anyone accountable when you're dealing with internal affairs. So either you need an outside body, and if you're not going to get to the outside body or it's going to take too long to create that, like obviously that's going to take time for the government to come up with that. So in the meantime, there has to be a matrix on what discipline looks like for every single charge and offense, if that makes sense. Just like we do with the criminal code. It's between this and this, like it's, because then you get rid of
subjectivity.
And the other thing is too, there needs to be specific charges that you lose your job. Because if you lose your job for sexual abuse in the workplace and being a predator, making it unsafe for women to work, then you don't have a job. And guess what? If people who are getting hired know that they're not going to have a job if they behave that way, guarantee you some of the, like a lot of that behavior is going to stop because no one wants to lose their job. They're doing it right now because they know they're not going to lose their job. They have nothing to lose. They get to behave this way and act like, you know, we're in a strip joint and they can talk to us and touch us and do whatever they want to us. Meanwhile, we're in a professional environment being treated like whores, ultimately. Excuse all my language with tickling of balls and whores and oh my.
Oh my God, Lee, this is too much. If you were going to, you should have told me this is how we're going to go. I would have started out differently.
Well, I'm always, I know that you and I can go off.
Oh,
you know,
God, I do, yeah.
Sometimes I need to be reined in.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're at a point, it's 2022. We've seen the lawsuits. We've seen the studies. We've seen what happens. It's just for some reason, why are we not looking at policing the same way as everything else? Just like everything else, if you're committing a crime and someone else is paying for it, you're not going to stop committing crime because someone else is paying for it. You know, when unions are paying lawyer after lawyer, police chiefs are hiring or have law firms, you know, in their back pocket, coming forward and silencing victims every time, you know, the police service is spending so much money. They're spending so much money paying lawyers, paying for NDAs, for, you know, getting rid of victims. They're spending too much money on covering up crimes and violence against women. So there needs to be an outside agency because what we're doing is we're just being stupid now because stupid is continuing to do the same thing and hoping for different results. And, you know, yeah, we can...
That's a definition of insanity.
Right? And we could keep raising the police budget, but then that means more officers are going to commit crime, more officers are going to get, you know, have lawyers come in and pay for... So it's just the escalation. And who's really suffering is women in all of this, is racialized people. And that's why I was like, fuck it. You know, I said, I need to get out there and I need to speak openly about this. Just to carry this type of stuff for this long. And, you know, it's like, you need to get it off your chest. Like, this is too much. We've seen too much and we're part of too much. And I feel like it would be a crime for me not to speak up about what I've seen, because to see it and not to speak of it is also complicity. So I feel compelled, you know, we all feel compelled that we need to pitch in. And even though it's a road of hell, it's like we're in war. Like every day I'm angry, but every day I'm, you know, also thankful that I'm not in that environment and I'm able to keep going and keep speaking up. So
I keep fighting. Yeah.
Keep fighting. Yeah. So I'm not looking for help from my police service. I'm not looking for them to come and lick my wounds and pick me off the floor. I know what they've done. I know what they're capable of. So I choose to go outside for help. I choose, and I've been so lucky to be connecting with so many amazing policewomen that otherwise you would never get to know if you're at work. If you're at work, it's really hard to connect with people because people look at you differently, right? They don't know where your loyalty is. They don't know who you talk to. But when you come out, you can truly be yourself. And in the last few years, even though it's been hell for me, like breaking away from that toxicity has also been a blessing.
Yes, I say the same thing, Effie. I say the same thing. Like, it really, I have gratitude for being away from it because it really got me back in tune with my morals and values that were eroded over time working in that environment.
Yeah. And, you know, I hope that people can see us and be hopeful about and really get involved in helping to really make things better for everybody, because this really affects the public more than they know. There is a disconnection here. That's why people don't understand why. Well, how is the police not doing their job, right? Like, they're not understanding. But what they need to understand is that the rules that the police follow is different. You know, the fact that we're not going into a courtroom for sexual violence, officer on officer, is because we have these tribunals that are so stacked against us. It's retired cops, retired judges, retired friends, retired neighbor. Like, everybody is sitting in a room. And I've stepped out in the last few years. I went to a few women's, you know, tribunals to be supportive, to see, like, to just see what the hell is going on out there. And every time I go, I see no support for the union. I see nobody shows up for these victims. And one in particular, an officer who had already pled guilty to sexual assault, was there. And, you know, his lawyer was so supportive of him. The union was there. The white shirts were there. And my heart was just so broken for this woman. And she was retiring too. And 30 years of being a fantastic officer. And this is how it ends for us.
Right.
You know, we have to like be very, very thankful, for myself especially, to be able to like come out and actually talk about it and connect with people.
Yeah. I've had some conversations actually recently with some of the women. And we've said, like, when you look at all of our skills, all of our investigative skills, we've got some of us who've been on, you know, I'm 21 years. Brenda, you've been on for 25 years. You know, we put us all together. We all have so many skills. We've worked in investigative units. I'd be happy to run an independent place for police women to come to report what's happening and for it to be investigated properly. Like, why can't we do that? What, like, but it's the politicians and the government that need to get on board with this, because right now they just do what the police want. Like, they're all in each other's pockets, and no one seems to be like, there hasn't been one politician that I know of to stand up and say, like, this is a big problem and it needs to be addressed. Like, it's not being addressed in politics. So before we close off, Brenda, is there anything that you would like to add in closing?
No, I appreciate this, the opportunity to have the round table, and know that the officer in the States isn't the only one. There's lots of us here, and it's good to get together and just realize we're not alone. We'll create our own table. We'll build our own house.
I love that. We'll build our own house.
Build it and they will come.
That's it. And it's already being built.
You know, we'll build it stronger. We'll build it solid. I hope if she hears this, that the officer from the States, that, you know, she knows she's not alone. Like my friend said, we have a huge network of us here and we're just growing. We're getting stronger. So thank you so much for having me here. It's been wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing your stories and your experiences. It gets me through every day. This is therapeutic for me. So yeah, thank you for everybody for sharing their stories. Like you said, Effie, I really do hope that the female officer somehow gets word that that there are lots of us out there to support. Because, I mean, when you see that happened, they haven't been charged. Why would any female in that service ever come forward about anything? They've set the bar for shut the hell up. And yeah, you're not going to shut us up. So we're here. And thank you so much for the roundtable, ladies. I really appreciate it. So hearts, thank you. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thanks for joining us today. Be sure to subscribe to the Behind Blue Doors podcast to catch the latest episodes. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And check out our website at www.behindbluedoors.org. Take care, and until next time.